Welcome to this edition of The World According to Irina Zuckerman, our very special series on global politics on the KJ Masterclass Live. Irina Zuckerman is a US-based national security and human rights lawyer, as well as a renowned geopolitical analyst. Her writings and commentary have appeared in diverse US and international media and have been translated to over a dozen languages. Every fortnight in The World According to Irina Zuckerman, we traverse the geopolitical landscape and delve into pressing international issues and gain insights from Irina's expert perspective. Welcome to the show once again, Irina.
Thank you. Glad to be here as always.
You are welcome. Welcome to the show. Welcome to India. And I'm sure we are talking about global politics, geopolitics, several big topics today. First, let's understand, you know, in terms of the US elections, because a lot of people are watching. Trump and Biden all advanced to the, both of these advanced to the next round. How should we understand this, you know, this contest going on? Like, again, it is the same like lifetime. What are people expecting there in the US? Who do you think is going to, you know, win this time? How does it look like the way they are moving? Because it's going to also impact the wars in Ukraine as well as in the Middle East.
Well, the two of them are two of the least popular politicians in the US, quite frankly, especially among young people. Both of them would most young people would rather not see either of them back in the Oval Office, unfortunately. For the time being, at least, it looks like it's very much heading in that direction, with the, you know, unless there's some dramatic development, unexpected issue making one of them, one or both of them, ineligible to run, or unless there's an open and contested convention either among Democrats or Republicans, which also seems very unlikely at this point, these are the two people who will appear on the ballot. The election is likely to be very, very close, even possibly even closer than what it was previously. Some of the swing states and even swing districts could be decided by just a few thousand votes. Trump, in his favor, has managed to attract more of the younger votes, assuming they actually turn up in the days preceding election. More Hispanics and African Americans, whereas most of the women tend to gravitate to Biden. There's also the issue of RFK Jr., who's already selecting his vice presidential candidates. He's running as an independent. So the question is, whose votes is he going to steal, or is it going to be about the same from both parties and therefore not make really a substantial difference? It will all come down to voter turnout. The mail-in ballot system is still in place, although it's not much discussed, and likely to favor Biden. Trump has not encouraged his voters to use the mail-in ballots for the early voting. Moreover, there are concerns that some of the Trump's changes in his platform could essentially run amok of some of his supporters. One of these issues is the issue of TikTok. He reversed himself just as a major bill is coming to a vote this week about whether or not to force ByteDance, the parent company behind TikTok, to divest of TikTok, or to enforce it to sell off, or to ban that app completely. So there's a very heated reaction to it on the Hill. Major organizations that are otherwise pro-Trump are backing the ban or the divestment measure. And there's a lot of heated controversy over Trump's entirely seemingly self-interested position over meeting an investor, which seems to have nothing to do with the campaign. So that could be one of the factors. Another issue that's happening is that many experienced and also younger promising members of the Republican Party in Congress are retiring, some of them early, creating a difficult position for MAGA Republicans, especially, although Republicans in general. Ken Buck is retiring next week, which means one of the hardcore pro-Trump voices, Lauren Boebert, ends up stuck in a difficult political position whether to run, and if so, from which district. It further erases a very narrow Republican advantage in Congress, and it sets up space for a very heated election come November in Congress. So the down ballots are also likely to be affected by what is happening, and most likely not in Republicans' favor. So even if Trump manages to secure a narrow, what is likely to be a very narrow victory, he is likely, this is not likely to affect lower races. Democrats are very likely to be far more aggressive there, and most of these candidates do not have the advantage of Trump's personal style, which earned him a truly cult following. So all in all, I would say that Biden has somewhat of an advantage, despite being seen as a weak politically on many issues and having a poor memory and so forth.
Right. So in terms of the two wars on at the moment, Trump has known, already said what he feels about US's involvement in Ukraine. And in terms of the Middle East, Netanyahu is not listening much to Biden. So how do you think this coming elections will impact these wars? Who would be rooting for? Will Zelensky be rooting for Trump or Biden? And what about Netanyahu? Will he want Biden, who he is not listening to, or will he root for Trump? Because I want to understand your expertise, your expert views on this. And even for India, I don't know who is going. I'm still not done that research, but I'm trying to understand who to root for.
Well, Zelensky is likely to root whoever, actually manages to provide him with aid. Biden is being reluctantly pushed into it. He seems to actually really want to bring that war to a close, and he has been hedging against it from the very beginning. But Trump, according to Viktor Orban, who was visiting this week, claims that he will end the war by simply denying all aid to Ukraine. And what, the Republicans in Congress are doing their best to freeze any possibility of aid until further notice. Meanwhile, centrist Republicans and Democrats are aligning to try to force the bill that would allocate more funding to Ukraine through. So I think Zelensky is closely watching it. I think he actually does not care who is in office as long as he gets what he needs for his country, and he will lobby aggressively whichever candidate ends up winning. And I think whatever Trump is saying now, I think it will be difficult for him to take a position that is completely anti-Ukraine, simply because Russia is already making aggressive moves elsewhere, and that includes the United States, it includes other parts of Europe. I think that, Trump's rhetoric may be one thing, but having to deal with institutional, congressional, and popular push is going to be something completely different, and I think he may have trouble pushing through his own agenda, especially if Congress is dominated by Democrats, if he is seen as completely giving over to Russia. That is not a popular position among most people, and while MAGA Republicans may be rooting for Trump overwhelmingly, most of the party may be under Trump's control, I think many of them, a good portion, still view Russia as a direct threat to the United States, and they're willing to provide some measure of support to Ukraine, if only for that reason. Regarding Gaza, Trump has had a personal falling out with Netanyahu, so he has changed his rhetoric. That could potentially be resolved. Biden, on a personal level, does not particularly like Netanyahu, but he on a personal level, until recently, he really was pushing to try to help Israel. But he is getting huge pushback from many Democrats and very well organized pro-Gaza demographics and activists. And we have seen a rapid change in rhetoric come the State of the Union speech, which was very political, much more election-oriented than policy-oriented. And I think he is taking this election element into consideration. He and some of the Democratic senators threatened to cut off aid to Israel if the Rafah operation moves forward. Netanyahu views this as an existential issue, and he feels that without winning Rafah, Hamas is going to remain in power. And so I think ultimately this issue may well be resolved before the elections and may become irrelevant after the elections, after the main thrust of these operations are already behind us. So at that point, I think it will not matter all that much. I do think that the Republicans around Trump are more likely to be overtly pro-Israel, but there is concern that some of the MAGA elements, some of the anti-Ukraine elements are also aligning with pro-Hamas factions. And we have seen some evidence of that, not only in the media, but now among some of the candidates for office who've reversed themselves. They've stepped away from the more extreme rhetoric on that front. But this level of isolationism is being very much propagated quite actively. And that may actually end up erasing Trump's advantage, because Trump himself is a polarizing figure, and until now his advantages were his policy contrast to Biden on China, on Israel, and a few other things. If he flips for whatever reasons, which could be entirely personal or they could be political, I think at least some of his base is likely to stay home and not vote, which would give a clear advantage to Biden and make all the difference in a very close election.
Right, right. And talking of U.S., how should one understand? On one side, you know, Netanyahu is not listening to Biden. On the other side, they say that, you know, Israel has every right to take its action for its defense or to whatever it wants to achieve. And on the other side, truce looks to be very difficult. It has not happened for Ramadan. And now U.S. is building a temporary fire to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza. So it's going to be a long-drawn conflict, which earlier we thought that it was going to be so many parties involved, it might end soon. How do you look at several things that the U.S. is doing, and sometimes it's giving a confusing sort of a signal to at least people like us?
I agree that the signals are very mixed. I think the most damaging thing has happened so far was not anything related to either Israel or Gaza specifically, but Biden's open appearance of willingness to interfere in Israel's democratic process. The signal that it's sending is so destructive to so many countries and on so many levels that I think they need to find some way of basically reversing course very quickly before it damages their chances, not only in this election, but in terms of long-term foreign policy for the U.S. You cannot just come out openly asking questions or implicating that, or using the intelligence rhetoric to claim that you are going to intervene in the democratic elections in a democratic country that you consider an ally. It's bad enough when there's a hot mic moment or interventions in authoritarian regimes. Even then, nobody is happy when something like that looks into the public ear. When it happens with an allied country, it damages the relationship, damages trust, and it sends signal of distrust to everybody else. And by the way, we are seeing things like that happen around the world. Zimbabwe just kicked out U.S. personnel claiming that they're fomenting political discontent and revolutions and so forth. So things like that just reinforce these perceptions, and they just damage U.S. influence anywhere in the world. regarding the long-term repercussions, yes, it's going to be long-term. Nobody promised a quick war, given the level of Hamas entrenchment, its institutional support by other terrorist organizations and regimes, and the level of propaganda around the world. If everybody wanted a quick war, they should be pressuring Hamas and forcing it to return the hostages quickly and give up power and go somewhere else and live in exile and let their people and let, you know, the Gazans choose a different government. That is not what is happening. I don't think everyone really wants a quick war, because I think what they want is actually just pressure Israel for the sake of pressuring Israel. And Israel is not going to be pressured over existential issues. It has faced far worse situations militarily and economically than the current war, and therefore it is not inclined to listen to a pressure on issues that will likely only damage it should it actually put an end to operations now. It will be perceived as weak. It will invite further attacks. It will invite further hostage taking, and it will also lose any potential prestige that it could retain in the region that is completely power focused. It's not humanitarian focused. By the way, the Arab countries that are claiming, that are crying crocodile tears over Gazans, who could have put an end to all of this again by pressuring Hamas, are also ignoring simultaneously far greater humanitarian crisis in Sudan, another Muslim-majority country that is in the midst of a devastating civil war that's only getting worse, and where, unlike Israel, there's no existential reason for the crisis taking place. It's entirely a power struggle between two warlords, and there's nothing more to it. So we are seeing a complicated geopolitical landscape, but I think and by the way, the interesting thing about the humanitarian the temporary period that you mentioned is that Israeli media leaked that allegedly it was Netanyahu's idea to implement that, and we have seen Israel praise that idea a great deal. It seems to be a more effective alternative to airdrops, which ended badly for everyone involved. But on the other hand, I have heard rumors of concern from some allies in the region about the implementation of this project and the fact that it could unwittingly involve extremists into the fray. And allegedly, Iranian Red Crescent has been setting up shop. Allegedly, such a temporary pier could invite delivery of contraband into Gaza from abroad, as has been tried in the past with a Turkish flotilla in 2010, which caused a huge rift between Israel and Turkey for many years. So we are seeing security-based concerns, which are legitimate, but that is not, I think Israel wants to demonstrate that this doesn't work. It's going to let US do that. It doesn't want to be seen as a complete obstructionist on anything humanitarian. But if it fails once again, then it will have every reason to tell the US, look, you tried it. We warned you, it didn't work. It only made things worse. So you have to put a stop to this. I think I have the option of doing that. And I think they will, if they really see it as a security problem.
Right. Talking of US, let's talk also of Russia. And there was an attack on, apparently, ISIS attack on a synagogue. And even Zelensky, he was, along with the Greek PM, he was near a Russian missile attack. What does these need? Are they insecure, secure, or these are also, some sort of diversionary tactics that different people are employing at different stages? Help us understand the truth, because there is so many things happening shrouded in mystery that it just, and if I remember correctly, if I read it correctly, if Zelensky is under attack and apparently the Pope is telling him to carry the white flag, how does that work if I've read it correctly?
So let's keep in mind the timing of all of these incidents, which is nearing the elections in Russia, where Putin is expected to run essentially unopposed. There are no serious alternative candidates that we know of. And I don't know why that election is taking place at all, given that there are no other candidates. I suppose it's to see how many people are going to stay home and not vote at all. But the outcome seems to be predetermined. Nevertheless, this is an opportunity for Russia to send messages to the world. And that's what I think they're doing. The attack close to Zelensky and to the Greek prime minister was a message. I mean, it's no secret that there's been multiple assassination attacks against Zelensky. The fact that they're doing that when there's a foreign guest nearby from a country that up until this point was relatively friendly towards Russia, at least on a financial level, although politically it's been increasingly supportive of Ukraine, that is essentially a terrorist gesture that they threaten to kill the prime minister, the head of state. It's a signal to that prime minister to change the political tune, or else they can be they can face consequences inside the country. What Russia is saying to Greece through this gesture that could be interpreted as an act of war, and I have trouble believing that Russia did not know who was there or how close they were, is that, you know what, if you don't stop, we can get you inside. Next time you visit here, we can get you inside Greece. We have assets inside Greece. I think that's the message. You know, with, in terms of the synagogue attack, or that was reportedly foiled, there's two ways to look at it. One is that Russia has been so negligent with the growing contingent of Islamists it has employed for various political purposes, like the Chechens, that they have, you know, they've run amok, and the internal security is not able or not willing to control it, or, you know, and Russia is simply an irresponsible actor which can't manage its own security. That is not a message that Russia would want to send to its own public, because it doesn't want to be seen as a weak, uncontrolled state. But it is a message that it wants to send abroad to say, to attract attention and sympathy, to restore legitimacy, and says, look, we are victims of Islamism. We're still with you. We are, you know, and we still, you know, we're trying to protect the Jews, and it's the bad Islamists that are attacking the Jews. I'm not sure who could be fooled by such, you know, by such rhetoric, given the history of Russia staging terrorist attacks for political effect. But given that it happened so close to the elections, I hardly believe that it's a coincidence. And by the way, as soon as this item got out, then, you know, no further details were released. Was anyone arrested? How did they make that determination? I think there's a very good chance that this was very much staged in concert with some Islamist elements, organized well enough for US and other embassies to issue a real security alert, but, you know, possibly even managed from a distance. Maybe these people were allowed to operate. And, you know, then Russia came in last minute to play hero. And thankfully, it did not get out of hand the way it has in the past when they tried similar situations with Nordost and Beslan and so forth. But honestly, I really believe that the timing is hardly coincidental, and given Russia's record, this is not. And given the way the whole situation was handled, this was not a real story.
Right, right. And especially if you see around Navalny's death, there were this German tape, you know, officer's tape that was released. And then during close to the elections, this synagogue reported attack has come in. And then there is not much after that. So many things happening in the world at the same time. We are trying to make sense of it all through you, Irina. And now let's move to China. In fact, now China is exporting cars to Russia, electric vehicles, installing spy equipment in the US cranes and sending more balloons. Where is China trying to position itself as a great car supplier, car exporter to Russia and maybe to the world later on? And in terms of how is it trying to balance its relationship with the US? It's a interesting thing. Means, what does it want to do with the US? Does it want to play games, or is it a part of a long-term strategy, especially starting, you know, with the change in guard, expected change in guard in the US close to the elections?
Well, China still wants to have a financial role in the US, just because there's so much dependency that it will take a very long time to fully undo all these things. And it does not want its own economic collapse due to a shortening investments. But it does not see US as an equal partner and co-investor. It wants it to be just a hub for certain controlled economic activity. It wants to send a message that it's the only superpower, not just one of the superpowers. And it certainly wants it to be a one-sided game, because we have seen that it has reoriented its economy to its detriment, by the way, towards so-called national security concerns, eliminating foreign presence, including private companies. At the same time, it's gearing up domestic production. Now, the EVs it's producing for export are far more profitable abroad than they're at home. But the reason they're making any profit at all is very simple. Yeah, there is actually a couple of them. The first is that China has the control of the raw materials that US needs to export, which makes the production of these vehicles significantly cheaper for China than it is for the US, and therefore the costs to consumers is significantly lower. The second issue is that much of the technology has been stolen from Tesla and other US companies. And I don't know whether Elon Musk will ever admit to it, but Tesla is being forced out of China as the EV vehicles ramp up. And I think he's made a lot of money for a period of time, but I don't know whether he'll find it was worth his while, given that his own elements of designs were likely incorporated into something that is now being used to kill the success of his own product. That's the irony of it in this whole situation. That said, there are other countries around the world that are also bringing relatively successful vehicles in Africa. Morocco is actually leading the production of cars and EVs, and India is, of course, also getting quite competitive in that regard. So who ultimately ends up dominating the market, and that's without, by the way, stealing Western designs. And Japan is producing hybrid cars that are more likely to be generally successful in the West than the current EV designs, in my opinion. And possibly also the new model of the hydrogen cars that are yet to be fully tested in terms of economic endeavor. They're at early stages of production, but also likely to be in the long run cheaper and easier to access for countries that have less access to raw materials than China and India. So all of these things are yet a very long-term investments. But China is not a friendly actor. The fact that friendly countries, partnering countries, don't spy on their friends so blatantly, of course, there's always some level of intelligence gathering, including about internal threats and other actors. But China is not really trying to hide it. It's very aggressively doing so, very much in the style of the Soviet Union, except with the better technology. And it's essentially sending a very blatant signal of we are going to do this on your territory, and unless you cut, you know, end all business with us, what are you going to do about it? And of course, ending business in China is costly. It's costly to the private businesses. It's costly in terms of breaching existing contracts. It's costly in terms of, you know, having to spend resources to investigate every time there's a delivery of something, cranes, spy balloons, some other technical deliveries, and it's a huge distraction, and it's difficult to deal with. But that's what China prefers to spend its own resources on, even as its own economy continues faltering.
Right, right, Irina. Now, you know, talking of China, what do you make out of its, you know, much more active involvement with the Maldives, which concerns now India? That, you know, just yesterday itself, it's talked about its sovereignty, safeguarding its sovereignty. The new president or prime minister of Maldives now, he is much more closer to China, and they are taking, but the impact of the relationship with India, with it taking back its soldiers and now sending replacing it with a civilian crew, is impacting Maldives' economy to a great extent, because it has impacted its travel and tourism sector. How do you see this part of this? What does China want to achieve out of this? Does it want to keep India on tenterhooks? But India is also leveraging its, you know, its economic power, especially in terms of travel and tourism. How do you see it from your part of the world?
Well, I think what many people forget when they look at Maldives, they think Maldives are just a tourist destination, and they must be wondering why would a nice place like that even bother changing one country for another? What difference does it even make where its money and production is coming from? But let's look who the government in Maldives is. It's actually very much an authoritarian Islamist regime with very little religious liberty, very harsh laws. And in that sense, it's actually much closer to China than it is to India, ideologically and structurally. And moreover, China is looking to build a cohesive bloc, and it's moving closer to Muslim majority and Islamist, in particular, especially states like Malaysia. And it's looking to kind of consolidate this hub of activity. It's also intervening in countries like Myanmar nearby, and kind of playing with both sides there, and fostering extremism and so forth. So it's not a coincidence. It's not just a matter of money. Because, of course, India is now becoming seen as a major investor, and not simply attracting investors, but also investing in other countries. So it's not just a matter of money or comfort. It's a matter of ideology. It's a matter of where there is a better natural fit. And what can China offer politically to Maldives that India cannot? And the real story here is that China is playing this complex geopolitical game, offering very corrupt positions and support and ideological support. And the fact that it's seen to be friendly with other regimes with similar ideology, this plays for sure a role. And I think unless people look at this ideological element, they won't even understand what is going on here, or why Maldives is even bothering, you know, with this switch. Where is it coming from? But you need to look beyond appearances.
Right, right. And talking of India, you know, our Prime Minister, he visited Kashmir very recently, and there we are talking about much more investments, much more development down there. How do you see this visit from all the voices that you have heard on this particular visit?
I think the visit was far more important than in the West, anyone in the West is willing to acknowledge. The West, by and large, has stayed away from the topic of Kashmir as an entity, as the part of the country that's facing its own unique cultural, economic path in certain ways, integration and so forth. The West is only focused on the controversies and political disputes regionally and globally over that area, and seems to be only interested in using that as a wedge issue. I don't see much concern for the welfare of Kashmiris as outside being used as a weapon to attack Indian government, to be honest. The one article that I've seen covering this issue in Western media was something along the lines of, oh, well, Kashmiris don't really care about the visit because most of the investments investment is aimed at the opinion of the rest of the country, the mainland, and not that particular region, which is silly. Why would the rest of the country care about an investment that doesn't concern their own regions? You know, right. So it's just not a viable argument for something like that. And notably, there's not a broad sense of interviewing people who live there about their issues outside those issues that the media chooses to give importance to. And I think it's kind of self-serving. You're always going to find some activists somewhere who are unhappy about something. If you only focus on the activists and ignore most people who live in a particular area, you're never going to get the real picture of what that community needs. And that, I think, is what the coverage of this Kashmir issue has become. It's become focused on activists and not on people, on the communities and the real people who live there and who need to live their lives on a daily basis outside, you know, political disputes.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Irina. And talking of, you know, news reports, what about the news reports about some Khalistani separatist allegedly, you know, movement picking up stream in California, USA?
Well, I actually found it very, very interesting that LA Times covered that issue, because now I think it's becoming something independent of particular episodes and controversy involving India's directly that we've heard recently. Now, this is just kind of a general trend that is becoming observable to people, and it raises real questions for average American citizens. If a particular group of activists is considered, or particular, you know, political lobby group, if they're considered extremists somewhere, should we not take it into consideration when giving these people legitimacy? Should anyone who is a political opposition or dissident, should they all be put in the same basket? Should anyone from, you know, that particular region be considered, you know, of seen the same? Or are there particular groups that do have, you know, views that should not necessarily be welcomed in other circles? And what do you do about people who don't have, you know, how do you balance a country's, respect for an ally's territorial integrity with self-determination claims by a particular group known for a series of extreme episodes? So I think I'm glad that actually this discussion is coming to the forefront of the press. I am not convinced that the media is well equipped to handle it correctly, but the fact that this discussion is happening, and at least people are starting to learn that these people are viewed different ways outside California, I think that's something welcome. That said, I do think, given California's political makeup and the general or at least widespread support for kind of semi-revolutionary movements, I think there needs to be a lot more discussion and conversation there about why not all of these groups are equally, you know, harmless, and why some of them are actually fomenting the sort of violent discontent that does not serve even their own political goals well.
Right, Irina. So we have talked about the US, Russia, China, and other India, and the reasons behind what they are doing. But what about North Korea? Why is North Korea preparing for war? Who is it trying to give it this message to? Is it to the world? Is it only to South Korea, or is it to anyone else? Help us understand about, because this is what we keep on hearing from about North Korea.
You know, South Korea and many others keep dismissing this threat as posturing and grandstanding. But when I see someone with the resources and ideology and opportunity to prepare for a major escalation, I would take these things very seriously, because the combination of these three factors are like a perfect motive for crime. You have the motive, the opportunity, and the weapon, and
right.
Then it's kind of hard to ignore. In this case, I think it's not only South Korea, simply because I think North Korea is increasingly looking at itself not just in terms of a forcible reunification with South Korea and essentially a power grab, but they're viewing themselves as a global international actor thanks to its intelligence reach, thanks to its to the cryptocurrencies stolen from very successfully from around the world, which is not possible to recover, and thanks to the opportunity and the, you know, the quiet and not so quiet backing from China, and now a stronger relationship with Russia, a strong relationship with Iran. These things now, North Korea is no longer the hermit kingdom. It's no longer isolated. It's very much part of a network, a coalition, a nexus, whatever you want to call it. It's acting in concert. It's exploiting global crisis. It's helping its allies in global crisis. It's no longer dependent. It's providing Russia with value, with weapons that are valuable and that are used in conflicts. It's becoming a regional actor that is not merely there to scare other countries into lifting sanctions. It's working with terrorist organizations, but it's doing so more as a more independent force. It's not merely the country best known for starving its citizens. It's still doing that, but it now has the actual power to do serious damage, and I think it should be taken seriously, not just by South Korea and Japan, but or even Ukraine for that matter, but also by other countries, also by Israel, because North Korea has a history of cooperating with Hamas and transferring perhaps Chinese weapons to the Middle East. It has, you know, and the United States, where it has significant reach through its intelligence, and where it could legitimately potentially hit Hawaii or California. So I think they may be somewhat less of a threat than the other three at the moment, but that doesn't mean that in very near future they couldn't be more, and they're certainly a bigger threat now than they've ever been in the past.
Right. Lots of things happening in the world, and a lot of, you know, posturings are happening. Some may be right, some may be wrong. Lots of happenings also in Haiti. There the president, he is not able to land on his own place. It's the interim president. What is happening in Haiti? It's almost very difficult situation on the ground. I saw some of the pictures on Reuters reportage and all. It looks to be a very difficult situation. How should we understand where Haiti is going? And even in terms of, you know, even in Nigeria, mass school children abduction by Boko Haram, and even in Mozambique, more jihadists, more terrorists, sort of people getting much more involved into Mozambique. Help us understand what's happening in that part of the world. How should we understand? Can the world do anything about these things?
Well, unfortunately, Haiti is a very complicated situation because it's been a mess for many years. It's been a bipartisan failure. No amount of humanitarian aid has been able to fix the situation, private or U.S. government. The criminal situation has been so completely out of control. The prime minister, the interim prime minister, just resigned. And now there's a battle for power between assorted gang leaders and others. And just because they managed to force the interim president to resign, and he was universally hated by all and held to be responsible for the murder of the previous president. I mean, you can't make this up. The others appear to be no better. Now, interesting enough, El Salvador's President Bukele offered to take care of the situation, but here's the major part distinguishing El Salvador, which faced very similar problems with poverty and violent crime, and the cartels and assorted, you know, groups playing a role, from Haiti. El Salvador has a functional government to deal with those problems. Haiti does not. So yes, on the physically the structure is, the landscape is the same, but how would any outside power be able to assist without having someone in place who would authorize the laws and the measures that need to be taken to put an end to this, that remains a big question. And so far, no one's been able to solve it. Secretary Blinken was in Jamaica for talks. Kenya was supposed to send reinforcement that they have been very reluctant to send, and there is no solution. Meanwhile, violence has gotten so out of control that several embassies evacuated completely. U.S. has removed non-essential personnel. I think it's only a matter of time before they also have to at least temporarily close the embassy. And Haiti is a strategically important location. It's become a hub for drug transfers, but it's also a hub for regional trade. So from that perspective, it does have strategic value and concern to the U.S., not to mention possibility of another refugee crisis that will add to the current border security concern. So all of that remains to be resolved, and I don't really see a clear solution in hand, short of imposing some sort of a interim government that will be propped up by the U.S. and a number of other countries. I don't see how this is going to get resolved peacefully in the near future. In terms of Mozambique, that's another location that is completely out of control. We've seen a movement of jihadis that once again caused another insurrection, caused another refugee crisis. They're causing, they're taking over territory. Wagner, formerly Wagner, now AFRICOR, have not been able to stand up to the, this is one of the areas where they have not been able to stand up to the jihadist groups. And other African countries have also not been able to send forces that could deal with this problem. And frankly, both central, northern, parts of northern and western Africa are all dealing with significant security issues, a combination of terrorism, separatism, internal disputes, political disputes. It's a mess. It's, you know, now we're seeing, you know, Rwanda and DRC on the verge of war, Ethiopia on the verge of another internal crisis, Sudan still very much at war. There seems to be no end in sight, so there is no real unified force to deal with the security issue with Mozambique, and in all likelihood it will continue to spread.
Right. So much of things happening in the world, so much of things to be taken care of by the world, and so much of things to be explained to you every 2 weeks by you, Irina. So as things happen, we will continue to talk to you and get a sense of what has happened in the last 2 weeks. With this, it's a wrap on this edition of The World According to Irina Sukerman. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.